We're going to switch gears now and talk about this Banner Week. Speaking of genetics, genes, Banner Week in genetics research. On Monday, Francis Collins, head of the NIH's National Human Genome Research Institute, announced the completion of the Human Genome Project, the huge international effort to sequence the entire human genome, or our book of life. I'll bet you thought we did that already a few years ago. Well, we'll talk about why we're celebrating it again. And while one project is ending, another is off to a strong start, because on Wednesday, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences announced the completion of the first phase of the Environmental Genome Project. And that's a project that aims to identify the individual variations in the genome that make some of us more or less susceptible to environmental triggers for disease. Why do some of us get sick and some of us don't? Well, maybe some of the clues will start coming out from the environmental triggers that we're discovering about these genes. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about the Human Genome Project. And where do we go from here? What comes next? Endeavors like the Environmental Genome Project. If you'd like to share your opinions and ask questions, be my guest. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Bruce Rowe is the George Lynn Cross Research Professor and Director of the Advanced Center for Genome Technology in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. He joins us today from his office. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rowe.
Oh, thank you, Ira. Nice to be here.
You're welcome. Debbie Nickerson is an Associate Professor of Genome Science, University of Washington in Seattle. She joins us today from her office. Welcome back, Dr. Nickerson.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Bruce, I thought we already celebrated the anniversary. I remember 2000. In the year 2000, it was a big celebration. What happened? What's the difference between this genome project and the original?
Well, the original celebration that we had, that the announcement in 2000, was that we had what was called the working draft. And so we had a fairly complete sequence. Over 90% of the genome was publicly available at that time. And now what's happened is we've gone on and dotted the I's and crossed the T's and figured out what some of the sequences were that were missing from that draft, first sort of pass sequence, and now have a really, really complete picture of the whole genome. In fact, it's down to just around 400 gaps remaining, and those are pretty much intractable regions. But now we know a tremendous more about the evolutionary origins, repeated sequences that were difficult to sequence early on, and we fine-tuned and corrected some of the mistakes from just a draft sequence.
So we got 99.99% finished?
Yeah, something of that order.
Something like that. And these gaps we don't care about, these 400 gaps?
Well, things in science are it's always the things that are odd or different that we like to look at, and surely we want to know what's in these gaps. In our work on chromosome 22 that we published in 99, which was the first genome, first chromosome that was sequenced of the humans, we had a dozen or so gaps. And since then, we've closed and finished another three or four of them. And so what we've learned is that the sequences there are interesting from a scientific point of view, but they really don't encode any genes, mostly evolutionary remnants, that help us kind of understand how the genome got to be where it is today.
Debbie Nickerson, I remember in 2000 when we were talking about the preliminary mapping that was going on and hearing scientists say, the easy stuff is over now. Getting the map was the easy part. Now the real work is going to begin trying to figure out, what to do with all this information. And I guess you've started along that path already.
That's right. I mean, one of the areas that everyone is greatly interested in is how we all differ in our basic sequence. So we have this master sequence now that exists of the human genome, but we know that we all have differences in our sequence, and we'd like to get at those and take a look at what are the common variants that exist in the human genome and how does this relate to our phenotype, what we look like, what we're susceptible to in terms of diseases, or even our resistance to disease.
Mm-hmm. So in the project that you're working on, the Environmental Genome Project, are you looking at the differences, the small differences in the genome between individuals that might make them susceptible to environmental influences?
Right. In the first phase of the project, we focused greatly on the genes that are involved in DNA repair, in fixing DNA mutations that may occur in our DNA from exposure to environmental agents. Mm-hmm. And there are many small differences. These are single base or single nucleotide changes that exist in our genome inside of these genes that will help us look at our susceptibility to environmental exposures.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Debbie Nickerson and Bruce Rowe about the Human Genome Project and the Environmental Genome Project. Take your calls. It's a fascinating subject. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about the Human Genome Project and the Environmental Genome Project, and Lord knows what other genome projects might be down the pike as we talk about the completion of the map of our genome. Our number 1-800-989-8255, talking with Bruce Rowe and Debbie Nickerson. Dr. Nickerson is the Associate Professor of Genome Sciences, University of Washington in Seattle. Bruce Rowe is the George Lynn Cross Research Professor and Director of the Advanced Center for Genome Technology in the Departments of Chemistry and Biochemistry, University of Oklahoma in Norman. Boy, these titles sometimes get along. You have to get less money so you don't have to get all those big chairs. Our number, 1-800-989-825, is our number. Dr. Nickerson, tell us about how different are our genomes. I mean, how much variation is there between people?
About one in every 1,000 base pairs varies for those things that are common in the genome. I mean, essentially, many more variations exist, but those are not common. You wouldn't find them in just looking at a few individuals. So we're very interested in the common ones that and how they may be associated with disease. So that would be like one in 1,000. So we're 99.9% alike.
But it's that silly little millimeter, as they used to say in that tobacco commercial.
Right.
But that tiny little difference really accounts for so much.
Right, it does. Well, if you think about, Bruce can tell you more about the difference between chimp and humans. We're getting a better estimate on that now. But there's a small difference that makes a huge difference.
Bruce,
what is it now, Bruce, 1 or 2%?
Yeah, it's something between 98 and 99% identical.
From chimp and human, and that's a huge difference.
Right.
Now that, and Bruce, now that they've gotten the whole the genome sequenced, there was that controversy how many actual genes there were and things, and you know, have we narrowed it down, or are we basically staying the same with that number?
That number is a toss up. It really depends on how you want to define a gene.
Right.
Okay. And so the number now seems to be settling something around 30,000 different genes. And that's kind of a little disconcerting to people because the plant genome that was sequenced, this sort of weed called Arabidopsis that was sequenced, has, you know, 27,000 or so genes. And so, you know, we really don't have any more genes in a plant. And now with the rice genome, yeah, that's even slightly more than humans. So some plants have more genes than humans. I think that what's amazing is how do we get to be what we are with such a small number of genes. And in fact, that's one of the areas for future work, because it turns out that in the human genome, each of our genes has the ability to sort of make a different product slightly by different ways of splicing the parts of the gene together to make a functional message, which makes a protein. Mm-hmm. And on average, that's between 3 and 4 different proteins from one gene. Okay? Whereas plants and some lower organisms mainly don't do that very much, maybe 1.5 to 2 times. So we have a lot more diversity, I think, in humans, but that's roughly the same amount as in chimpanzees. And so it's sort of, we're at the tip of the iceberg now.
Mm-hmm.
I like to kind of explain it to people that we've gone through and we now have a dictionary. The only problem with the dictionary is we believe we have most of the words in the dictionary, but only half of the words have definitions.
Mm.
And so the difference between the working draft and now, for over the last 3 years or 2 years, 2 to 3 years, has been that we've figured out more of the words and corrected some of the spelling. But we still have a long way to go to just get what the definitions are of what these genes are actually making as gene products. And what's even more exciting, too, is the kind of work that Debbie and the group is doing is now they're looking at the words that are kind of misspelled from time to time. And so some of those are dastardly misspelled words that cause diseases like cancer and stuff, but others are just slightly misspelled and maybe, you know, that gives one a little more propensity to atherosclerosis or something.
Mm-hmm. And Debbie Nickerson, you're looking, your lab is looking at genetic variations that contribute to heart disease.
Yes, we're doing that as well, and we're very interested in the basic inflammatory response. When you get damage in your body, you will mount a whole series of responses that will help fight off the damage that's occurred. And these genes are looking like they're playing a key role in predicting actual cardiovascular disease in humans. And we're looking at the natural variation in, as Bruce called it, the misspellings in those genes as well, and very interested in how they may be related to the development of heart disease.
Bruce, if you know what the gene sequence is it possible to figure out and how the genes do what they do and know what life is?
That's a tough one, okay?
If the genes make the what they have the instructions and help make the proteins to create life, living things.
Yes.
How close is that a step to figuring out making artificial life?
Oh, that's making artificial life is
I bit off too much on that question.
Yeah, you said about 16 things.
I'm glad he asked you that, Bruce.
I like that. You sound like one of my students when they ask a question. But, no, I mean, I think that there's lots of questions that people are addressing. I mean, there's a group that's trying to say, what's the minimum number of genes and gene products you need to make a cell? I mean, my heavens, we have viruses that have one gene, basically, is all that they have. Now, they're parasites. They infect something. They infect a cell, but they have just one gene. They're a life form. Okay? Then you go all the way up the tree to humans and literally trees, and no, we've got 30 or so thousand genes. And so what's the minimum amount to make a living organism, and can we make a living organism artificially? I don't really know whether that's an interesting thing to do or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a long way from there.
quite a long way. In fact, what's frustrating, I think, to a lot of people is that we've known for I don't know how many years. I mean, I remember in graduate school quite a number of years ago studying sickle cell anemia and the specific mutation there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't replace that gene for hemoglobin yet. We don't have a method. Well, people are working on it, but we just really don't have a viable way of taking a defective gene that we know about and correcting that genetic defect. What's exciting, I think, about the Genome Project is that we've developed from the Genome Project tremendous number of earlier tests for these diseases so we can get diagnosis much earlier. And then new drugs will come out to treat these diseases and to hopefully inhibit the bad aspects of them. But correcting it is a long way off.
I also think we might have new insights into susceptibility, Bruce. For example, we know that some individuals are more susceptible to cancer from exposure to the sun. I mean, if there were a brief little test for that, I mean, people would know that they should wear more sunblocker when they're out in the sun.
But would you know how to
increase their susceptibility or eliminate it?
But would you be able to eliminate it? Would you be able to eliminate that gene or correct that bad gene?
Well,
I hear Bruce saying we can't do that yet.
Well, I mean, it's not a possibility now, but there are thousands of scientists working on aspects of gene therapy and how to correct that.
Right.
That's just one of the new technologies that's emerging.
Oh, and we're really hoping that comes quickly rather than slowly, but Debbie's absolutely right. I mean, what the advantage of having this now completed sequence is we really have it fine-tuned, and so a lot of tests can be developed, and hopefully I can go and find out whether I should be careful, more careful than I'm told to be when I go out in the sun. Okay? And so there are a lot of tests that will be coming fairly routine to do to help people to diagnose what kind of a susceptibility or propensity they have towards everything from cancer to heart disease.
Mm-hmm. So give us a little thumbnail sketch, Dr. Nickerson, about you have all these genes, you found out that the variation among people is 1,000, one in 1,000. Mm-hmm. How do you go about figuring out which of
one in 1,000 base pairs, not one in 1,000 people.
Right. Which? How do you go about figuring out which of those base pairs and the combinations are important for a certain defect or lead to maybe causing a disease or something.
No, this is a big area of research now and sort of the next generation of the Human Genome Project, and this area has been labeled the haplotype map, or generating the hap map of the human genome. And the idea is to, we have 3 billion base pairs of DNA now that we have the sequence for. We know in those there are about 6 million differences that are very common in human populations across the planet. And what we're trying to do is to identify those very common variants and look at how they've been associated with one another down through the dawn of mankind. And actually we're finding that many of them have been associated together, and they actually form what we call blocks in our genome. And you can think of these as these blocks as being like having a few flavors. And so we might actually be able to reduce looking at the human genome and its entire sequence from 3 billion down to maybe even 500,000 of looking at these key sites that are in these blocks. So you could get a significant reduction. So we could look at people's susceptibilities with these 500,000 differences and look for these changes that may be important in cancer, cardiovascular disease. And this is what our work in cardiovascular disease and the Environmental Genome Project are all about.
Mm-hmm.
Getting at these markers that we can use to actually look at common susceptibilities.
Mm-hmm. Bill in Lansing, Michigan. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. A question that's slightly off topic. I'm wondering if have been any theories or studies about how genetics influence behavior, and if so, whether within the Human Genome Project there's been any work in finding genes specific to human behavior.
Well, Bruce, go ahead. Tackle that easy question.
I'll tackle that easy question, and probably Debbie knows enough too. But it turns out that a lot of the diseases that we've tackled over the last decade with the Human Genome Project are diseases that are linked to single gene defects.
Right.
And also with we've gotten up to maybe 10 gene defects with some cancers and things of that nature. But when we're dealing with the brain, we're dealing with personality, behavioral characteristics, there are probably hundreds and hundreds of genes that are involved in that complex trait. And so that, I think, is one of the aspects of where the haplotype map, where there are blocks of regions. And so what people are trying to do now, and quite a large number of scientists are involved in the haplotype mapping, and what they're doing is trying to find what these differences are, and then trying to look at the individuals, the hundred or so individuals that they're looking at, and seeing if any of these complicated blocks of DNA show any consistency with various complex personality traits. Right now, I don't think we've put our finger on any one, but hopefully over the next few years, I mean, and very quickly, there will be some correlations with some of the haplotype blocks and complex disease traits.
I mean, Bruce has hit on it. The behavior is probably one of the most complex traits that we look at, and even defining it well in terms of scientific study, there's a lot of controversy over that, and you need a definition of that before you can look at the genetics of it even.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the Human Genome Project, other projects, where we go from here on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones from here, because lots of people have lots of questions. Let's go to Raul in Michigan. Hi, Raul.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is there a consensus on what constitutes a gene and what's not a gene? Because it will seem to me that, you know, if you have this very close similarity between primates and humans, maybe we're missing the point. Maybe it is quite possible that what we recognize is just a sort of a first-order pattern, and there might be a bunch of other patterns buried in there and the stuff that we don't understand yet that might be a gene. See, a gene may not be a gene.
I get it.
this is Debbie. I think that's a very important point, and actually one of the things that Bruce is greatly involved in is resequencing many different genomes of many different organisms, and this could be key to finding genes that we couldn't find by some of the ways that we have today to computationally look for them, and actually could help us find the keys to how they turn on and off and how they know how to make how much they should in a certain tissue.
Yeah, I mean, could the unit of the gene be the wrong thing we're looking at?
Yeah.
Well, it does so happen
I think
that
it probably is.
Well, one of the things that has fairly recently over the last 6 months really come out of some analysis is that years ago some of us used to study small RNAs. Mm-hmm. And these are transcripts and of the DNA. And basically what we kind of define a gene as now is something that has been transcribed into RNA. But there are, most folks think that, oh, well, but that gene that was transcribed then gets to be translated into a protein that goes off like Pac-Man and Carry does a job. All right. But now there's a whole group of small RNAs that are transcribed, that are not translated into proteins. And I hate to say we have no clue, clues are slowly emerging as to what the function of these small RNAs are. They're involved in regulating all kinds of aspects of how the gene processes occur, okay, from transcription and translation and recycling of messenger RNAs and stuff. So there's a whole new, really exciting group of genes that we really only a few folks thought about earlier that are now coming to the fore, and there are thousands of these small RNAs that are made off the genome.
Spooky.
So exciting, not spooky.
Yeah,
we each have
exciting.
Our own way of expressing excitement.
Well, those of us in the research lab like to think about this as job security for our students.
That is a spooky concept. So we really don't know what these, you know, wow, we don't know what these little RNAs are doing then, or why they're there, things like
but
that.
But they're carrying out work in different processes, which is very important, and it was very unclear until the last recent times that we understood at least some of their functions.
You know, you're getting to sound like the cosmologists who come up with, you know, they got the dark matter and the dark energy, having the dark RNA that there are parts we don't know.
I wouldn't quite call it that.
I don't think it's that dark. I think it's really part that's shining more light on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's turning out that, you know, most of what we do in science, you know, we make a hypothesis and then we go in the lab and do some experiments to test that hypothesis. And the hypothesis was that we could develop methods to sequence the genome, and now we have the genome and we've done those experiments, and
Bruce,
we now have to look at those results and design new hypotheses.
Well, I have the hypothesis. I have to take this break, or I can tell you we don't need an experiment. We won't get back. So stay with
us.
Stay with us. We'll come right back and finish that thought. So don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan on the next Talk of the Nation on Monday for a fresh take on an age-old question, what's the role of the poet in society? We're talking this hour about the Human Genome Project, which is poetry to some scientists. And future of genetics research, my guests are Debbie Nickerson of the University of Washington and Bruce Rowe of the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Our number 1-800-989-8255, and when I rudely interrupted Bruce, he was telling us about what scientists are doing in their laboratories.
Well,
you can finish that, or we can go on to a question.
Why don't you go on to a question?
Okay. Well, let me ask you this question, because my question is going to be, were there any surprises, Bruce, that you found that you turned up now that all the chromosomes have been sequenced?
Well, the first surprise that we've already talked about is that there are all these small RNAs that
right.
seem to be encoded. Okay, that was one really, really big surprise. The second surprise is how the evolutionary remnants are spread throughout the genome, and how there are large repeated sequences that are on same sequence repeated on multiple different chromosomes and where they are. Another surprise was that some regions of the genome are very gene-rich and some are very gene-poor. And trying to understand what other features in the genome, as that earlier caller talked about, are involved in helping that process along. So it's actually been quite a remarkable, lots more questions, I think, than we like to have answers to.
Hmm. Let's go to Alan in Miami. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Great program.
Thanks.
I was going to ask, what if there's some sort of key, whether it's a key gene or a key substance, sort of like a master, or maybe in computer language, like a directory file, or like on a website, a site map, that has the information of where all the other stuff is supposed to go. And if you start messing around with the stuff underneath and you change something that might not correspond to the map, couldn't you get equivalents of an error message or do some very strange things by playing around without being able to inform the entire system that it's been changed?
Debbie Nickerson?
Yes, that we've been looking at that actually in animal models, and it's genes that we thought were very important for function have been knocked out and found not to be as important as we thought. We have lots of redundant systems inside of our body, obviously, because a lot of the protein products and the small RNAs are interacting with each other to carry out these functions, and I don't think we have the wiring map that would really address your question, but it's something that everyone's very interested in, and certainly the now with the unveiling of the entire complete genome, we'll be able to look at that wiring diagram a little bit better, kind of who does what to whom.
You know, what tells,
and where?
What tells the genes how to work with each other?
Well, they have the sequences that are nearby are involved in binding with common proteins. So if you want to turn on a gene for a certain stage of development or a genes that you're going to make a liver or you're going to make a kidney from or something, there are some specific regions that are common to all of those genes, upstream from those genes, that regulate those. And so you have a whole set of proteins that are involved in turning on specific genes at specific points in time. And I think that's maybe Debbie can say more.
Yeah, the other thing that Bruce brought up was these alternatively spliced forms of the genes. And actually, they can get turned on in the liver to make one form of the protein that does a function and perhaps be turned on the brain with a smaller or larger form to carry out an entirely different function. And we're only beginning to understand those kinds of dichotomies of, you know, one gene having multiple functions in our body depending on where it is and in what tissue it's in.
And that would explain why we have so many fewer than we thought we might have.
That's right.
Yeah, because they... Well, okay, Alan?
Yeah, I just a quick corollary, if I could.
Sure.
Corollary question would be, what do you see as possible inherent dangers of playing around with some of these things and splicing things and not reaching the master or something or other? Could we come up with some fairly difficult or dangerous things?
Go, Debbie.
I think it would be difficult to do that. We have such a limited understanding of some of our human genome now that I don't even think we have a clue of where... We have a clue on a few of the master genes, but actually messing around with those is usually not compatible with life at all.
Right. And the other thing is that a lot of the genes, for example, in humans, 80 or so percent of the genes, and maybe more depending upon how you want to look at it, are present in zebrafish. And... 90% or so are present in mice, 80 to 90% at least. And so a lot of the experiments that are being done to do some sort of genetic manipulation, which is essentially knock out genes or make those gene product productions slow down, are always being done in model organisms to test them first. A whole bunch of genes, quite a number of genes that are in yeast are the same as they are in humans.
Human.
Very close. And so, we do those experiments in yeast, so we don't go at it blind in humans.
But I think one of the enormous things that has come out of that is how redundant our systems are. You can think of us as the most advanced jet ship, and we have lots of backup systems.
Backup system is important. What about, Dr. Negerson, you were talking about identifying genes that may make us susceptible to heart disease. What about identifying genes that might protect us from heart disease?
That's quite possible. You can think about it in terms of everyone knows somebody who can eat anything and doesn't gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I was one of those people, but we all would be interested, is there a genetic component to that? What is it about this person's physiology that may allow them to handle these kinds of things? And we could actually test for this now with this new HapMap and see if there are key genes that we didn't know about before that were actually involved in
mm-hmm.
in our metabolism and how we handle kind of the things that we're eating.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You could actually think about getting new pills so everybody could be like that if they wanted to.
Dr. Rowe, is there a possibility that we could become too complacent in what we think the genome is made of? And I say that from the fact that, you know, I look back 25 years ago and I'm thinking of the particle physics people who thought, you know, that they were trying to simplify, and they instead found more and more particle zoos out there.
Well, I don't think that we're becoming complacent. This is the whole system of genomic science, and science today is very, very competitive. And so everyone is really looking for the fine-tuned details and trying to come up with ways of studying them. The complacency sort of says to me, well, you know, the genome is done.
Right.
What's next? And it turns out that what's next is, what are these genes doing and how are they doing it? And how are the gene products interacting with each other?
Mm-hmm.
And how do they vary?
And how does that affect the whole system? What is the effect of that variation? And it's more so that that's sort of what my little hypothesis thing was, is you know, we've answered one phase of the question, and that's now opened almost a Pandora's box of questions. So I don't think that scientists are going to be complacent here. I mean, we have so many important issues to deal with that we really haven't touched on in this discussion.
Give me one.
How do we relate this to healthcare?
Mm-hmm.
Right? How do we relate this to solving problems in the world that we can do from a genetic basis? How can we get earlier detection of these? How can we maintain our privacy in the whole effort?
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of questions. Scientifically, we want to know what these genes are doing, when they're doing it, what the gene products are doing, how they're interacting with other gene products. Basically, how does the toaster work? And we're the toaster, or life is the toaster.
Mm.
And so it's really, I think that the kinds of experiments that are needed are going to evolve over time. But there are a lot of very, very important questions that we now, because the genome is completed and at the stage that we have a really good picture of it, we're now able to now design the next stage of experiments to address those issues.
We're talking about the Human Genome Project and what comes next on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here with Bruce Rowe and Debbie Nickerson. Bruce, Debbie, how vocal should scientists be in some of these issues? Do they just sit there and work with their DNA and RNA and let those problems solve themselves, like the privacy issues?
No, I really think that that scientists should be vocal about these issues, and there should be lots of forums for people to be vocal about them. For example, in the Environmental Genome Project, one of the things that the National Institute of Environmental Health is very interested in, scientists is interested in, is to take a look at, we have standards for environmental exposures to lots of different chemicals that are out there. But are the levels that we're saying, are they good for everybody? I mean, we want to identify whether some people may be susceptible to the kinds of levels that we say are acceptable today. And if we do find that people are more susceptible, we want to lower those. You know, we want to actually up those standards so that there'll be less of that chemical in the environment. So I think these are all very important issues
that could greatly influence
our healthcare and our lives.
On the other hand, I could see someone saying just the opposite. Well, we know what gene is susceptible, makes you susceptible to some sort of pollution. Let's make a drug or get you fixed so that we don't have to stop polluting. We don't have to worry that much about it.
I think that's a global issue, but I think that we shouldn't be exposed to those kinds of chemicals.
But to partially also answer your question, I think should scientists be active in promoting an understanding of what's been done and how it applies to daily life for people and how it's going to be making things better? There's always the alternative that bad things can happen. And I think that we have to speak up on these issues, just because we could. There's a philosophy of, well, we can do this, let's do it. And I personally think just because we can do something doesn't necessarily mean we ought to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I mean, there's so much to learn. I mean, most people think about this in terms of disease susceptibility and learning perhaps negative things. But you can also think about it as, why do people live longer? I mean, can we find out what the genetics of people who live for a really long time and live productive and healthy lives, do they have a certain genetics?
Mm-hmm. Is there any?
We all want that.
Is there any politics going on out there that prevents you from doing any kind of the research that you want to do?
I don't see any.
Mm-hmm. No, not as far as what we do.
No, we're it's based on hypothesis-driven research and we're trying to answer scientific questions. I think the problem, if there is any politics, which is not really the politicalness, but it's there really isn't enough money to do this research. There's a lot of money in the Genome Project and at the National Institutes of Health, but relatively speaking, it's a drop in the bucket. I think that Congress has risen to the occasion and tried to provide money for research, but this is a time now where there's a tremendous knowledge base and we can really move forward quality of life for people to gain a better understanding of every process under the sun, including aging and disease and normality.
Where are the pharmaceutical companies that will make huge profits off these things that you're doing?
They're taking advantage of it, and that's great. And then they in turn pay taxes, which is even fine, So it eventually gets back into the system. But I think that, in fact, part of the next phase, there are several diseases and several problems that we need to address in healthcare that pharmaceutical houses are not addressing because they can't make $500,000 or, $500 million. So we have a lot of orphan diseases.
All right.
And so one of the goals for the next phase of the Genome Project is to open up this kind of small molecule research in as part of the Genome Project.
All right, we're going to have to get into that next time we talk about it. Remind me, okay?
We'll
get into the small molecule. We've run out of time. Thank you both for joining us. Debbie Nickerson, Associate Professor of Genome Sciences at University of Washington, Seattle, and Bruce Rowe, who is in the Departments of Chemistry and Biochemistry, University of Oklahoma in Norman. Again, thank you all for joining
us. Ira, thank you. Debbie, take care.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome.
Talking to you, Bruce.
Have a good holiday weekend for both of you. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineer is our Matt Galick in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinh. And if you missed anything, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find all the links we talked about and more information on what we're doing on Science Friday. Have a great weekend, a good holiday. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.